Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover World podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, join historian and filmmaker Sam Dalrymple for an illuminating discussion on his debut book, Shattered Lands. Dalrymple examines five pivotal partitions of modern Asia that dismantle the British Indian Empire and reshaped modern Asia. Recorded live at the 2025 Festival, explore how historical partitions continue to influence contemporary geopolitics and identities across the region.
Hello and welcome, everybody. Thank you very much for being here. My name's Samia Rahman and I'm your chair for today. I would like to introduce you to Sam Dalrymple, who actually I don't believe needs any introduction, but I will introduce him. So Sam is a Delhi-raised Scottish historian and filmmaker. He spent the past 22 years living in Delhi. He graduated from Oxford University as a Persian and Sanskrit scholar and also studied at the University of Isfahan and Ferdowsi, University of Mashhad in Iran. He's worked across South and Central Asia, including stints with Turquoise Mountain in Kabul and with the Aga Khan Trust for Culture in Hunza and Lahore. In 2018, he co-founded Project Dastan, a peace-building initiative that reconnects refugees displaced by the 1947 partition of India. His award-winning debut film, Child of Empire, premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2022, and his animated series, Lost Migrations, sold out at the BFI the same year. He's a columnist for Architectural Digest, and in 2025, Travel and Leisure named him champion of the travel narrative. He runs the history Substack at Travels of Samwise, and Shattered Lands is his first book. And a little sort of side note, he does have a father you may have heard of called William Dalrymple. Thank you, Sam. So Sam, we'll start with a presentation.
Yeah. No, thank you all for coming and thank you for that lovely introduction, Zaria. Wow. Lovely packed hall. So thank you. This is literally kind of week two since the book's come out. So it's wonderful to see you all here today. I'd like to begin with this image on this screen over here and begin with the fact that there's this myth that I kind of grew up with that you could see the Great Wall of China from space. And it's a complete myth. And even if you were to sit on the International Space Station and squint your eyes as hard as you could, you wouldn't be able to see a thing. In fact, there's only one wall that you can see from space, and it's the border between India and Pakistan that you can see this line 3,000 kilometers long, a line intended to divide Hindu from Muslim that, like a scar, now runs from the Arabian Sea through the plains of Punjab and all the way up to just a few kilometers from K2, the second tallest mountain on planet Earth in the high Himalayas. This is just one of many incredibly fortified borders that now stretch their way across modern South Asia. The longest border in the world is actually the India-Bangladesh border. And there's currently a massive new border being erected between India and Myanmar, Burma. And what's extraordinary is that just 100 years ago today, not a single one of these borders existed. If you go back 100 years, this entire region is known as the Raj. It's Britain's primary colony. It's often referred to as a British colony, but it was more like the British colony. It was vast and constituted a quarter of the world's population in a single colony, the largest Hindu, Muslim, Sikh, and Zoroastrian populations on the planet. 100 years ago today, it's still standing very strong. The Victoria Memorial is being opened in Kolkata. This extraordinary kind of Buckingham Palace meets the Taj Mahal, made of the same stone as the Taj Mahal. And the capital is currently being moved to New Delhi, which is on the right-hand side, where Lutyens, the kind of, you know, designer of country houses, is building the largest architectural development ever seen in the British Empire, which is now modern-day New Delhi. A century ago, the news looks like this. And I was looking for what I thought was one of the most important news stories of the century, really, which is when the Indian National Congress, the largest political party in India, declares its aim as full national independence. But actually, bizarrely, the British Empire is so confident at that moment that it's actually one of the small bottom right-hand corner stories. And the primary story that day is the fact that the British Empire is trying to begin stretching into space. And so the number one story there is Hello the Universe, the BBC's first attempt to contact aliens. And it sends out this radio waves saying, hello, all stars and nebulae, have our waves reached you yet? At which point there's no response and the BBC presenter sheepishly moves to dedicating a new broadcast to the people of India. Now, what's weird about the India that he's referring to at this moment, 1928, just under 100 years ago today, is that it's a much, much larger India than I think we are used to today. This is the Indian passport of a Yemeni Jewish woman who was trying to migrate to Mandate Palestine immediately after the Balfour Declaration. Now, by virtue of her being from the Yemeni city of Aden, she was automatically considered an Indian citizen and thus had to migrate on an Indian passport, or an Indian Empire passport, as they were known. So there she is. And if you look at the list of princely states, about one third of India was never actually under direct British rule. It was ruled through these semi-independent vassal states known as princely states. So think kind of, you know, Jaipur or Jodhpur, Hyderabad or Bhavalpur, these sort of things, the Maharajas, Sheikhs, Nizams, etc. But alphabetically, the first state on the list of princely states is Abu Dhabi. And if you go to B, you can also see Bhutan in there. This is evidently a much larger India than I think we're used to today. So this is actually what it looks like in 1928. Legally, under the Interpretation Act of 1889, this is India. It's stretching from what's now basically modern-day Yemen as far east as modern-day Burma. And you can see yellow is the semi-independent princely states, and pink is the bits that are actually run as British India. Today, countries that once constituted part of British India, there are now 12 of them. These include Yemen, Oman, the UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, Pakistan, India, Nepal, Bhutan, Bangladesh, and Myanmar. This is a much larger story than I think we tend to realize. The collapse of the Raj, the shattering of the Raj into 12 nation states over just 50 years through five distinct partitions. And these are partitions that have created many of the conflicts that I think we live through today. Most notably, the conflict between India and Pakistan that just, you know, last month threatened to go nuclear, probably the most dangerous nuclear confrontation we've had in the 21st century so far. But also everything from the Rohingya genocide, the Gulf War, the nuclearization of the South Asia conflict, of course, but also insurgencies in Balochistan, Kashmir, Northeast India, the Chittagong Hill Tract in Bangladesh, and Burma's civil war, the longest ongoing civil war in history. So 100 years ago, it was the New York of its day. It's kind of been forgotten because the Burmese government has kind of gone into isolation over the course of the 20th century. But there's a quote from the immigration officials of Burma in 1933, which is that until recently, Rangoon was second only to New York City as an immigration and emigration port in the world, but now it is number one. So we've completely forgotten this, but you can see it just by wandering through the streets. Over just a 4-minute walk, I walked from the largest synagogue in Southeast Asia through the Tamil Hindu bazaar to the Chola Durga, the Tamil Sufi shrine, and then ended up at the Armenian church with this wonderful wooden spire. But Rangoon and Burma in general had become one of the most multicultural places in the globe and one of the richest. And yet, as this influx of immigration occurred, there was increasing xenophobia towards the new immigrants. And what follows is remarkably similar to what we saw, I think, around Brexit, with debates turning on whether, like, Burma should separate from a massive economic union and the pros and cons of mass immigration. And it's very weird reading it. But what's also weird is quite how central Burma was to the idea of India in the 1920s. So this is a newspaper article from The Scotsman, and it says, "The attitude towards the separation question is one which strikes deep into the very existence of India itself as an entity. If one province breaks loose, no reason can be shown why similar claims by others should not be granted." And it then goes on to basically say that Burma has as much in common with India as any other province, which today, when we're used to 75 years of static borders in a world of nation states, seems completely, completely bizarre. And yet, at the time, Burma was considered much as integral to the Indian nation as Bengal or Madras, according to this article at least. And so the question of whether Burma should be separated is one that really divides Burmese society down the middle. You have the man on the left here, Mahatma Ottama, one of Gandhi's great disciples, and, you know, briefly the head of the Burmese wing of the Congress Party, saying that Burma is an integral part of India and should remain so. After all, India was the homeland of Buddha. And, you know, Burma is a majority Buddhist nation, has had very, very historic ties to India. Gandhi, on the other hand, comes in 1931 and says that Burma never showed up in the ancient Hindu epic, the Mahabharata. It's not part of this nation state that Gandhi's trying to create called Bharat, which is a kind of the land that's mentioned in the Hindu epics that roughly stretches from modern-day Pakistan to modern-day Bangladesh, but doesn't include the Arabian or the Burmese parts of the Raj. And so that's the nation state that Gandhi wants to create. That this is roughly what that would have looked like. And this is the image of Hind Devi, the goddess of India. But ultimately, the Brits in this country all decide to side with Gandhi on this one. And in April Fool's Day, 1937, the first partition of the Indian Empire occurs. And you can see these wonderful stamps that are issued with a kind of crack dividing Burma's Shwedagon Pagoda from India's Taj Mahal, which is kind of an apt image for the cultural alienation soon to follow. In the wake of Burma's separation, a bunch of xenophobic politicians take over Burma. Even though it's still a British colony, the guy who will later assassinate Aung San Suu Kyi's father, U Saw, runs a campaign to basically exile the whole Indian population. What follows, he's the guy who, for example, reclassifies the Rohingya as a non-indigenous population. He says they should be sent to what's now modern Bangladesh. And he's a thoroughly nasty guy. And by the time that the Japanese invade in 1941 during World War II, the Indian population feels so insecure of what life would look like without the British there that 96% of the population flees overnight. This is a photograph I found in North London in the attic of my friend Sanvir. And Sanvir's grandfather is the young boy on the bottom left here. His great-grandfather is the man to the right of him, Uttam Singh. And this is the last photograph of the Sikh community of Bordwin, the mines, the gem mines of eastern Burma that they take just before the entire population moves overnight. Some 366,000 men, women, and children, 98% of Indian origin, although also some Brits and Scots and Arabs, etc., who'd been working there also flee with them. But it's this extraordinary migration, one that today in Britain, in India, in Bangladesh, and in Burma is largely uncommemorated. People have forgotten the results of this first partition. At precisely the same moment as Gandhi is creating this vision of a new Indian state that will roughly correspond to, you know, the geography of the Hindu epics, talk begins about separating off the Arabian states. These are everything from Yemen to Oman to Dubai, etc. And I think this is the bit of the book that the most people have found surprising, because I think even in the UAE today, if you go to Dubai, there's an understanding that, you know, Dubai was a protectorate of the British, But it's often forgotten that it was a protectorate of the viceroy, the British viceroy in Delhi. And that, for example, you know, the sultans of Oman for generations were all sent off to boarding school in Rajasthan's Mayo College in India. That the royal families of what's now Eastern Yemen were all relations of the Nizam of Hyderabad in central India. And that, you know, Dakni Urdu was spoken as the language of the elites for much of Yemen's 20th century history. Now, crucially, these debates are all happening before the discovery of oil. This is what Dubai looks like at the time. It's quite different from how it looks today. And so as a result, oil doesn't really feature in all these discussions. The Brits actually offer all these states as protectorates of independent India or Pakistan. And there's this bizarre quote that feels like the kind of greatest lost opportunity of either state, where I think the British delegation to Tehran says there was a surprising unanimity amongst all Indian officials that the Persian Gulf was of absolutely no interest to them. And so when in April 1947, the Gulf is finally separated off too. And so shortly afterwards, when all the other princely states are integrated into either India or Pakistan, the Gulf states will survive and remain as British protectorates right through into the 1960s. Now, these two events, these first two partitions, could have been some of the most defining moments of the 20th century for South Asia, but they've almost completely been forgotten. And that's partially due to what happened next. The Great Partition of British India that occurs in August 1947 is, without a shadow of a doubt, one of the central events of the 20th century. It's up there with World War II, the Holocaust, the Rwanda genocide, as one of those events that everyone in this room should know about. And if they don't, they should go read a book about it or watch a documentary. It's the lens, the prism through which a quarter of the world's population perceive their past, present, and future, and one that underpins one of the great kind of nuclear conflicts of our day. In the wake of World War II, you can drag this out to the kind of dawn of time, but the essential story is that in the wake of World War II, Britain is broke. And Britain announces that, you know, after Indian nationalists have been campaigning for the Brits to leave forever, Britain suddenly announces that it's going to do so within just a couple of years. And there's increasing worry amongst the enormous, enormous Muslim population of the subcontinent, where you can see where they were based on the left-hand side here, that they will almost always be subject to the whims of the even larger Hindu majority. And amidst increasing calls for Muslim self-determination, in August 1946, just 1 year before independence, the fight for a new independent Muslim homeland turns violent. Mobs begin descending on one another as Hindus and Muslims begin attacking one another. And what begins as one isolated riot in the city of Kolkata gradually spreads across the subcontinent. And in June 1947, the Brits, specifically the last Viceroy Mountbatten, announces that, concedes to the idea of creating Pakistan. But crucially, he then decides that he wants to rush the whole process and get Britain out as fast as he can. So rather than the supposed 2-3 years that he was initially tasked with doing this over, he decides he's going to do it in just 77 days. And so this is a photograph from a newspaper in India that I found in the archives just 1 month before independence. And what's remarkable is that no one still knows where Pakistan is going to be. Which of the states of India are going to be part of it? Will it include Delhi? Will it include Punjab? Will it include Bengal or Sindh? Who knows? And the whole process was so untransparent that it would lead to one of the great tragedies of the 20th century. With no time to divide anything, bureaucrats begin setting out on what remains possibly the craziest bureaucratic exercise ever undertaken by humanity. Famously, in a rush, some bureaucrats decide to give, when asked figuring out what to do with the Encyclopedia Britannica, A to K goes to India and L to Z is given to Pakistan. When trying to figure out what to do with the Mohenjo-Daro necklace, one of the great masterpieces from the Indus Valley civilization. This is a civilization that traded with ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia from 4,500 years ago. And it's a kind of, you know, a golden string with beautiful jade and agate and lapis lazuli threaded around it. And with no time, they decide to snip the golden thread in half and give equal numbers of beads to India and equal number of beads to Pakistan. And in the process, no one quite figures out who, like, which land is going to which country. And so actually it's only announced where Pakistan is 3 days after Pakistani independence. It's only on the 17th of August that a border between the two is actually announced. And so if you look at the maps from the time, they're completely bizarre. In this uncertainty and in this chaos, the largest forced migration in history begins. And this is a migration that the grandparents or relatives of many of the people in this room will have probably undertaken. 12 million people migrate in the course of just 9 months, with Hindus and Sikhs moving from what's now Pakistan or Bangladesh to India, and with Muslims moving in the other direction. Between 1 and 3 million people never make it. And it's something that just like lives with us to this day. I began working on partition about 7 years ago. And I think growing up in Delhi, as soon as I began talking about my work, it gradually became clear that almost every single friend I had had some sort of partition story. It's one that will be, I'm sure, in the questions, someone will want to share their family story. I know we were chatting just beforehand about your family's story. And so this is the defining moment in modern South Asia. Now, contrary to popular belief, the British lawyer Cyril Radcliffe would only be tasked with dividing British India, that directly ruled portion that constituted about 2/3 of the subcontinent. And so this is basically the map that he draws. But at the time, 1/3 of India and Pakistan are not part of India and Pakistan. And actually 80% of the modern India-Pakistan border is designed by the decisions of 7 of the princes, these maharajas, sheikhs, nizams, who are depicted in what I think is one of the most fabulous images to have discovered from the book. This is the ruling princes of India that was painted after the Delhi Durbar in 1911. These are all the leading princes in their states. You can see in this image that these states vary dramatically in size. So whilst Hyderabad was essentially a country in its own right with a larger economy than Belgium and, you know, a population larger than about 20 UN nation states, Kashmir was larger than France. You also had states like Kamadia, which was in modern Gujarat, where the entire population have one photograph all sitting together in the same frame and was essentially like a kind of, you know, a country estate rather than an actual thing. But these states are not part of the Great Partition. They all become independent in August 1947. And so it's not just two states that are born in August 1947, but something like 569 or something like that. And 80% of the border is created by these states basically joining one country or the other. And I think although a lot of nationalist histories in the past have essentially just assumed that Hindu states joined India and Muslim states joined Pakistan, that was simply not the case. And virtually every single state basically shopped around and tried to ask what the other one could offer. You had Jodhpur, the lovely blue city that many people will have visited in Rajasthan, one of India's great tourist sites, that spent months negotiating with the government of Pakistan about what it could offer Jodhpur if Jodhpur joined Pakistan. And it's created several of the conflicts that we see today. So some of the states tried to remain independent. In the case of Hyderabad, the Indian army actually had to go in and annex the whole state, leading to a population displacement 3 times larger than that seen in the Palestinian Nakba the same year. This is an enormous and completely forgotten internationally refugee crisis. And you get situations like in Balochistan, where the parliament of Kalat state basically votes to remain independent, but the Khan, under pressure from the Pakistani government, will eventually join the state to modern-day Pakistan, basically dividing the state about whether it should have remained independent. And we've got an insurgency that continues intermittently to this day. And then, of course, we've got Kashmir, which it remains one of the great conflicts of the 21st century, just as it was of the 20th. Kashmir in the 1940s was a majority Muslim state ruled over by a Hindu Maharaja. And initially, the Maharaja had wanted the state to remain independent, a Switzerland of the East. But as partition riots basically filter through the state, leading to a mass pogrom that basically kills many thousands of Muslims in the city of Jammu, the Pakistani government begins sponsoring, without the knowledge of its founder Jinnah, begins sponsoring basically what's known as the Jihadi Lashkar, basically a group of, they declare a jihad to try and take the Muslim majority region for this Muslim state, Pakistan. Now, the Hindu Maharaja will cede to India in self-defense. The Indian army will go in. Soon the Pakistani army goes in too. And you're left with an informal division of what was once one state, which continues to be denied. You can't show it as a border in India and Pakistan. And it's bizarre. Even trying to publish the book in India and Pakistan, you have to change the maps because you can't show the line of control as, you know, where the government control is. In India, you have to show all of Kashmir as India, and in Pakistan, you have to show all of Kashmir as Pakistan. You can't show this line of control. But this is the UN map, and it roughly shows you the bits that are currently under Pakistani and Indian administration. Now, by the 1950s, you had a map that would have seemed utterly strange to the majority of the population in the early 1900s, 100 years ago today. But it wasn't the map that we're actually used to today, because what's now Bangladesh was still part of Pakistan. It was East Pakistan, because there were actually two Muslim majority regions that had made up the Raj, one in the east and one in the west. And early Pakistan is actually a very different place from the one that exists today. For example, in the first decade, you have four Bengali, sort of modern-day Bangladesh, four Bengali prime ministers running, four of the first eight prime ministers are Bengali. You have Bengali and Urdu both represented on the coins here on the right. But when the Pakistani military takes over in the 1960s, you're left with a situation which almost completely cuts the Bengali population out of the country's governance. Thanks to a British policy that was enacted during the Raj, which was only inducting what was known as martial races into the army. So the Brits had this thing that meant that families like my own, Highlander Scots, as well as Punjabis, Sikhs and Muslims, less Hindus, were basically encouraged more into the army because they were considered to be of martial stock. Whereas other communities like Bengalis were virtually ignored in army recruitment. Now, what this means is that once the Pakistani army takes over the country, suddenly the Punjabi population become the de facto rulers of the country, and the actually over 50% of the population is Bengali, and yet there's something like kind of 2-3% Bengalis in the governance of the country. There's a long and storied history. The government spends less on the east as it does the west. And when military rule finally comes to an end in 1970, and there's an election, this man here, Mujibur Rahman, wins the election. He's a Bengali politician. And again, it's too long to go into here, but the Pakistani army refuses to accept him as their next ruler through a mix of basically kind of suspicion about separatist tendencies, but also just blatant racism. And so the Pakistani army is sent into Bangladesh. And what proceeds is 9 months of bloody, bloody conflict that will lead to the independence of modern Bangladesh. In Bangladesh, it's known as the Liberation War. Pakistan refers to it as the fall of Dhaka. And India only really refers to its brief sort of appearance in the end of the story as the Third Indo-Pak War. Now, language is political, and each of these it's you know, essentially meant to assert their own specific government's narrative. But what you do get is, in the course of a single year, 1/10 of Pakistan's population is rendered refugees in northeast India and West Bengal. These are some of the political posters from the Bangladesh freedom struggle. And it all culminates in this, which is the surrender of the East Pakistani army and the creation of South Asia's youngest nation state, Bangladesh. Now, today we look at much of the news and we see sort of titles like this, India and Pakistan, the nuclear standoff that we should really all be worried about. There's a particularly insensitive one that I saw recently, which was this: if Indians and Pakistanis can relocate, why can't Gazans? As if the partition was a resounding policy success story. And then we see these sort of comments. It's often forgotten that much of the idea for partitioning India and Pakistan on a religious basis was based off of the partition of Ireland between Catholic and Protestant, and just 6 months later would be applied to British Mandate Palestine to create a Jewish and an Arab state. Now, two of these conflicts are continuing to bleed into the present in very violent ways at the moment. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, the Irish conflict was, until within living memory, just as violent, but that, you know, a peace process has been rolled out. We look at these conflicts very often as completely unsolvable and, you know, as if there's no way out. I think Trump was recently talking about how India and Pakistan have been at war for thousands and thousands of years, brushing over the fact that there are, you know, people alive today who remember a time before these borders. So before moving on to our little discussion, I'd quickly like to just talk about the human connections that still exist between all of these different communities to this day. I think, so I got into this through working on this organization called Project Astan that I founded with a friend from Pakistan and an Australian Indian friend who grew up in Delhi like myself. And we had, my friends had this conversation where we realized that Sparsh, who's on the left here, would probably never get to visit his ancestral home in what's now Pakistan. But our friend Amina, whose family lived just, you know, an hour away from his ancestral home in Pakistan, would be able to visit it easily. Likewise, Sparsh could visit Amina's ancestral home, but that had been rendered inaccessible to his own family. And we spent basically 4 years using virtual reality technology to reconnect families over this border to, you know, we could film your old mosque on the other side or your old house, your school, whatever it might be that you wanted to see again, and try and track down long lost friends. And now working in this organization, it became very, very clear that despite politics essentially always talking about how, you know, Indians and Pakistanis are meant to hate each other and this is one of the great, you know, conflicts of the day, there are still so many connections across this border. And I think we'll get to it in our discussions in a bit.
Thank you very much, Sam. That was a brilliant presentation. I think you'll all agree with me that that was just very fascinating and insightful and really kind of enriching when we think about sort of our perspective and our understanding of the region. Now, I'm going to hand over to the audience soon, but if you'll just allow me to ask the first question. I know probably you're all sort of primed with questions for Sam, but I'll begin by asking you, you spoke a little bit about sort of, you know, the kind of the interconnectivity within the region. And what we get in your book, I think, is this real insight into what life was like before the invention of the nation state and the level of cooperation and a sort of a relationship between the regions that was so much more than the hostility that we see now between India and Pakistan. Was that something that surprised you or was it something that you expected?
I think that, I mean, to some extent, you know, growing up in Delhi, I don't think that there has ever been a more jarring and strange experience than my first visit to Lahore, where, you know, I've been to around India numerous times, to Jaipur and Lucknow and all these other North Indian cities. And yet Lahore in Pakistan is more similar to Delhi than any other city on the planet. And more than just visually, culinarily, you know, the types of people that you meet and the kind of class distinctions between this area, that area. And I think that, you know, it was a shock then. I think by the time that I got to writing the book, I was more used to it. But I was definitely astounded by how, you know, none of the borders made sense. I think India and Pakistan, by the time that I was working on the book, I'd worked on partition enough to understand quite how arbitrary so much of this was and how interconnected, you know, Hindu and Muslim communities were across the subcontinent, as well as, you know, Sikh, Buddhist, Baha'i, all sorts of different communities lived in different places. But, you know, the going to the Burmese border, for example, with India, and realizing that, you know, half of all Nagas or Mizos live in Burma today, and that that is a partition as much as any other. Realizing that, you know, each of these borders are ruptures in their own way, even if they haven't been told in the same way as I think 1947's story has been. But also the ways in which, you know, I think what also surprised me was, by and large, the Brits who were out in India very much kept to their own separate thing. But there were all sorts of fascinating stories of slightly kind of socially exiled, kind of mixed race families, Anglo-Indian families. There was one story that I came across in the archive of a Scottish family that had married a Khasi family in what's now Meghalaya in northeast India. And when independence came, they weren't sure which country they, you know, were they going to be asked to go back to Britain or were they going to be asked to stay here? And they spoke Khasi as their first language and then Scots as their second.
And they really occupied a space sort of beyond the sort of colonial project.
Exactly. And I think that so many of these, you know, what's been fascinating has been, you know, traveling across, say, you know, Sindh and Balochistan and the Northwest Frontier and learning about what Peshawar's once thriving Hindu and Sikh community looked like. And then also, you know, what today you go to cities like Amritsar, you know, in modern day India, where the Golden Temple, the most sacred place in Sikhism, is. And to learn that that was 100 years ago a Muslim majority town, and now there's virtually no Muslims who live there, but, you know, the second grandest building in the city is the old Jama Masjid that was abandoned until just 20 years ago when it was renovated by a bunch of UP Muslims who'd come over and, yeah.
My tribe.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Oh gosh, I have so many questions that I want to also ask you, but I will now open up to the audience. If you could raise your hand if you do have a question. I might do it one by one, if that's okay. And if you can keep your questions short and not sort of, you know, observations or commentary. I'll begin with this gentleman at the back here, and then...
Thank you for that fascinating tour through partitions. I had one, just a clarification question, something which I had been told many, many years ago through history books. It was that Oman had an enclave within, on the border, on the coast of Balochistan. So when I looked at the princely state map, I was wondering if it would show something, and it wasn't obvious, but I just wanted to check.
That is a major part of the book. So the story of, for those who don't know, Gwadar, that is now present-day Balochistan in Pakistan, and is being, you know, there's currently a lot of investment to try and turn it into the big new port in southern Pakistan, was right until the mid-50s, the northernmost point of Oman. And there were, just as there were kind of, you know, Indian bits on the Arabian Peninsula, you had Arab bits of what's now the Indian subcontinent. The man who gets it, so there's a story that you'll read a million times about this woman called Vicky Noon managing to kind of get it over. She actually had nothing to do with it. And I went to stay with the family. Her husband, Firoz Khan Noon, who's the last democratically elected Pakistani prime minister before the first coup. It was very interesting going to his house in Lahore for researching this and seeing they've got the letter that Iskandar Mirza gives Noon to say, you know, your government's been dissolved. Parliament no longer exists in Pakistan and there is now military rule in the country. They've just got it in their house and it was kind of, oh my God. But that whole story I've gone into in quite a lot of detail and it's rather fascinating. Noon, the last, you know, democratic prime minister there, is the only Pakistani ruler other than Muhammad Ali Jinnah, its founder, to have succeeded in expanding Pakistan. You know, despite the aims of the Pakistani military for decades afterwards to try and kind of, you know, push the line of control in Kashmir further, he's the only prime minister who, it wasn't just Gwadar he managed to get, he managed to resolve all sorts of, you know, border conflicts that Pakistan had at its birth and massively expanded the country. And is this kind of almost forgotten and downplayed figure in Pakistani history? But thanks for that question. Next question. I think we've got someone up front.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for a fascinating talk. I just wanted to say I'm also from Delhi, so fellow Delhiite here. My nani, which is my maternal grandmother, came from Lahore in February 47, and that was the last one of the last few marriages in 1947, and she never went back. So I just wanted to make that observation. My question is, you probably would get this at some point, about what you think about the future now, given the rising Hindu chauvinism and Hindu nationalism in India, and what do you see about the future as regards to partitions in particular?
So I think, you know, in short, it's not looking particularly good, is it? as the recent war, I think, showed us. I think you never know when peace could come, and it's often come in the most of, you know, the closest that we've come to resolving any of these, like the Kashmir conflict, for example, actually came under the previous BJP government under Vajpayee, whose discussions with Nawaz Sharif and then Musharraf are always cited by every single politician as the closest that they ever came to resolving the conflict. I can't remember exactly what it would have involved, but it would have involved kind of basically, it was based on the Good Friday Agreement and would have allowed Kashmiris to cross without any border restrictions. But the line of control would have been a sort of firm border for Indians and Pakistanis who weren't from Kashmir. And it would have involved, you know, demilitarized zones across the region, UN controlled, etc. So there is always hope. I think that particularly in places like Bradford, you know, we have this unique opportunity in a way that you can't in the subcontinent for kind of Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, Burmese people to all come together and speak about their family histories. And so often it's, you know, you hear these in terms of polarizing stories. It's only by chatting to people from your kind of neighboring nation states that you're able to sort of realize the sort of ridiculousness of all of this. And yeah, I mean, I think this is what makes cities like Bradford so incredible. So yeah.
Great. There was a lady at the back.
Thanks for a brilliant talk. My question is about historiography. So with the creation of these nation states, with these five partitions, presumably that led to the need for a nationalist historiography and the kind of myth of the origins of each state. In your travels, in your research, did you come across any countervailing views where formal study of the past actually looked at the interconnectedness of the region before the creation of states? I mean, of course, there's anecdotes, personal archives and so on, but did you see anything that actually went against the kind of concocted nationalist historiography of these states?
Thank you. Yeah, great question. Yes. I don't pretend to say that, you know, I think what's original about my book is putting all these stories together, putting all the partitions together, but there's all sorts of amazing research from all of the countries involved that very much goes against this kind of nationalist historiography. What I do think is that, you know, with each of these partitions, the archives themselves were partitioned. And so, you know, for example, the whole story of the fact that the Gulf could have ended up as part of modern-day India or Pakistan was largely forgotten because, you know, the entire archives were sitting in Bombay. And it's only recently that, you know, you've had Khaliji scholars from Abu Dhabi and Qatar, etc., being able to go to Bombay archives and realize that that's where all their pre-oil archives are. And suddenly this whole new, you know, era thing has opened up. But, you know, still, obviously, you know, anyone studying partition in India only has the Indian archives to work with. I think the digitization of archives by several groups, including the Qatar Digital Library, which is exceptional, and the British Library has done an incredible job, as well as archives like the 1947 Partition Archive in Berkeley that collects oral histories. I think each of these has done an incredible, incredible job. I think oral histories and oral historians are having a particular moment in South Asia right now. So, you know, there are ones from the 80s like Ravashi Batalia, but recently you've had amazing historians like Anshul Mahotra, Kavita Puri based in Britain, or Anam Zakaria based in Pakistan, who are going around interviewing people from border communities, you know, looking at archives, really questioning a lot of the assumptions that we've lived with. And I think it's particularly often people who've had, tragically, you know, it's becoming again difficult to travel between these countries. I know both Anam and Anshul and Kavita have had the ability to, you know, cross between these countries because at various moments the border has been more fluid. And one of the sad things as the border goes up is that, you know, the ability to do this work is becoming harder again. But thank you for that question. anymore.
There's a yes.
Hi, thank you so much for the great talk. Since I'm researching on a similar topic, but it's a very micro case study of a region which is in constitutional limbo in Pakistan, Gilgit-Baltistan, and I mainly research on Hunza's environmental history. So I came across a lot of layers which are emanating from British colonization Belt and Road Initiative, and there are no written archives. But still, when you were talking about partition, so I just want to understand the tension that I encountered being a researcher, though I'm from Hunza, but still the people's story that we talk about, the experience, it may not be mainly partition. There may be a lot to cover, but how do you take into account those ideas or stories which are local, which may not be a divide of a religion, which may be more than beyond the environment resource conflict or resulting from any other tension? Even you just shown us a video where the old man has fondness of his village in Pakistan. So he might not have the same perception of partition that we are studying nowadays or we are seeing. So because some scholars do argue about the Orientalist narratives and frameworks, which are not really taking into account the broader or wider perspective of what people's experiences are, maybe they haven't really seen as what we are seeing as a religion, conflict of religion. So how did you take into account those tensions, if you have ever come across?
Yeah, no. So firstly, there's all sorts of stories. I think the key thing here is oral histories, which I was mentioning earlier. So a lot of the groups like 1947 Partition Archive are very much going around interviewing people, not just about migration, which, you know, of course, affected a huge swathe of people, specifically in the most affected areas were Punjab or Bengal or UP or Hyderabad. But also oral histories about just the way that everyday life has changed in the 30s, 40s and 50s. And so environmental history is, you know, one of these things. I think in terms of Hunza, one of the, you know, it wasn't so much partition. There was never that much of a, you know, a Hindu population, even though Ganesh village at the base, just below Baltet, you know, was once a Hindu village centuries ago. There, that population has been gone for centuries. But the story of the integration of the princely states and the creation of that border has massively affected Hunza, and the way that, you know, Hunza, for all intents and purposes, was completely independent princely state under the Mir of Hunza. But the Brits basically shove it under the purview of the Kashmir Residency in 47, which is, you know, and this callous decision to put Hunza and Nagar under the veil of basically Kashmir means that when the Kashmir conflict opens, they stop being recognized as independent states, despite the fact that they basically were independent of Kashmir until just months before the thing. And so, you know, to this day, it continues to be endlessly dragged into a dispute that, you know, people from Hunza ultimately are not part of. So I think there's all sorts of interesting debates that are happening about all of these things. I think that the more that we, you know, go through archives and the more that we look at oral histories and see just how differently these events are experienced in different parts of the country or the region, like, you know, that's always a good thing. More voices is always a good thing. But yeah, thank you.
Great. There's a gentleman at the back. And then if we have time, we'll go to this gentleman, but I'm not sure. But if you could make your point very clear.
Yeah, I'm interested to talk about the partition of Ireland has potentially been a blueprint for the partition of India. And then you alluded to the Good Friday Agreement. I just wondered, are there any academics or politicians from Ireland who have been making perhaps a significant contribution to the ongoing events in Kashmir, or is that something that's occurred?
So, strangely not. There has, I feel like not enough people. You get occasionally, like, what is fascinating is how Ireland keeps on coming up throughout the process. So, you know, one of the opening scenes of the book is the Chittagong uprising, what's now Bangladesh, one of the great kind of, you know, moments when revolutionaries seize a town and kick out all the Brits from it. And that this group call themselves the IRA, and they are the Indian Republican Army, and they do it on Good Friday. And, you know, and I think Sinn Féin has a massive impact on numerous Indian nationalists and Pakistani nationalists and Burmese nationalists. And yeah, if you're reading through the archives on, you know, where, figuring out where the border is going to be placed when Cyril Radcliffe, et cetera, is drawing the border, the terms that they keep on using are, you know, we don't want to create numerous Ulsters. They use the term Ulster because, you know, the creation of Northern Ireland, et cetera. So throughout, there was a major, you know, Irish presence. In the 90s, there was again, as I mentioned, in the wake of the Good Friday Agreement, there was this little push. And I think that there was this hope that similar things would happen in the subcontinent. There hasn't been a lot of Irish, like, vocalness on this conflict since then, as far as I know. But I know numerous Irish academics, though, who very much go and talk about this. Jane Olmeyer, for one. Final question, which we might have time for.
Oh, we can. Yeah, we do have time. I've been given the thumbs up. Very quick question. We've got 1 minute left. Yes, this gentleman.
Thank you. Thank you for the amazing talk, Sam. I just have a comment to make. So my family comes from UP and they never migrated to Pakistan. We are UP Muslims. And in fact, we did a reverse migration. We went into one of the princely states called Bhopal, which was one of the second largest Muslim states.
That's where my husband's from, Bhopal.
And I always used to ask my grandfather, why did you do that when all the Muslims were leaving for Pakistan? You went further into India. And he said, he used to say, because nobody took it seriously. They thought this is all temporary and it will just die out in a couple of years. They'll be together again. So did you come across stories in your work? And my second question is about this Dastan project. How much are you facing resistance from the present Indian government because they don't want people-to-people contact?
Latter question very quickly. We were surprised by how little we faced. And there was occasionally kind of local policemen that would get a bit shifty, being like, why are you doing something with Pakistan? But because we were working with the museums in Amritsar, Delhi, Lahore, and we had, you know, because we'd gone through these channels, we actually were very easy. Secondly, yes, numerous people didn't think that the border would ever solidify. I think that the most sort of basic example of this is the fact that Jinnah never sold his house and always planned to retire to Bombay, and the fact that his daughter stayed there. His daughter never migrated. So him, like, you can read his daughter Dina's letters to her father, and he's really sort of sad on Independence Day because his daughter isn't coming to join his new nation. But, you know, I think that they always expected to see each other again, and they didn't. And that's the founder of the country. You know, Nehru and Maulana Azad always talk about, you know, always expecting to be able to kind of go driving around the Northwest frontier again soon. And yes, so I think there's a huge amount of talk early on that these borders might prove temporary, or that you might end up with some sort of, I think the situation that actually most people expected was something a bit like the UK, where you have Scotland, England, Wales, and Northern Ireland, right? And I think that that's the situation that quite a lot of people had expected to emerge out of this. You have Nehru talking about a United States of South Asia. You have Aung San, the founder of Burma, talking about something similar. Jinnah sort of accepts the idea of creating, you know, Pakistan as a federal region of a united India, although Gandhi later pulls out of it because he wants Peshawar to be part of the Indian bit rather than the Pakistani federal bit. It's this small little nitpick. But, you know, it could have almost happened. And we could have had a very different story. So, yes.
So on that note of the constructedness, the socially constructedness of borders, we will have to socially deconstruct and bring this to an end. Thank you so much to Sam.
Thank you.
Really, really interesting. And thank you to all of you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.